Portland and the county because of a lack of transparency about how the money will be used. The latest plan states that money will be used to rehouse 275 households and create 140 more shelter beds by the end of 2023. The money will also go towards supporting the mass homeless encampment planned by Portland, located in the southeast. In order to get that funding, that site may have to move to more rigid sleeping pod structures, not just tents for people living outside. Funding is projected to be available in just 10 days on April 28th. Hundreds of students at Portland's Ockley Green Middle School walked out of class on Friday to protest the treatment of black teachers. Two black teachers, a dance teacher and a librarian, were put on leave by the district for, quote, personnel issues, but students characterized the move differently. They marched around campus chanting, "Black teachers matter." Ockley Green has recently also lost other teachers of color who have pointed to being mistreated by the administration. The middle school has also been under scrutiny for a video that appears to show Vice Principal Spencer Crum going into the girls' bathroom and locker room. Students protested about that last month as well. Crum is also reportedly named in a federal Title IX complaint about a gym teacher being dismissive and unfair to female students. Data released by the Portland Police Bureau show 1,789 cars were stolen in the first 2 months of 2023. That's an average of 30 cars per day, which is similar to the daily rate for all of 2022. And the Bureau report shows thefts are much more common in some neighborhoods than in others. Most of the 2023 car thefts occurred in neighborhoods east of the Willamette River and west of Interstate 205. But the neighborhood with the most thefts in early 2023 is on the west side. 74 vehicles were stolen in the Northwest District. That's followed by three neighborhoods on the far east side: Hazelwood with 71 vehicle thefts, Powellhurst Gilbert with 61, and Lentz with 59. Police officers in the East Precinct have been performing special stolen vehicle operations missions. Specifically, they pull over drivers they suspect are operating stolen cars in focused areas. They also analyze data collected from traffic stops. A stolen vehicle is found in an average of one in every six stops. 88% of the cars stolen in 2023 have been recovered, with 84% returned within 30 days. The top five vehicle makes stolen in 2023 have been Kias, Hyundais, Fords, Subarus, and Hondas. New legislation in Washington state aims to support child care workers. It also extends eligibility for the state's assistance program to children who are undocumented. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
This session, lawmakers in Olympia passed legislation designed to provide aid to the state's child care system. Senate Bill 5225 opens up access to child care to more parents in Washington. Ryan Preco with Child Care Aware of Washington says it expands the Working Connections child care program to workers in the field.
This actually allows child care providers themselves to be eligible for child care. This is really something the legislature did that we're excited about, trying to target the child care staffing crisis that we see playing out in programs.
The legislation expands the Working Connections child care eligibility to child care workers making up to 85% of the state median income. The assistance program helps people pay for care. The bill also ensures eligibility for families in therapeutic courts. The program is extended to children who are undocumented as well, by removing questions about immigration status from applications. Gabriela Quintana with the Economic Opportunity Institute says the bill is a step forward for the state.
This bill is exciting because it does cover so many people and it just expands eligibility for folks to participate.
Quintana says while there were gains this session, lawmakers will need to do more to fix the lack of affordability and child care availability across the state. The bill was passed by the legislature last week and is on Governor Jay Inslee's desk. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader discuss the debt ceiling. Washington State protects trans rights in a new bill. And Arkansas's Election Integrity Unit comes closer to fruition. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In the coming weeks, the House will vote on a bill to lift the debt ceiling into the next year, save taxpayers trillions of dollars, make us less dependent upon China, curb our high inflation, all without touching Social Security and Medicare.
At the New York Stock Exchange, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy outlined Republicans' plan for passing a one-year debt ceiling increase. He and other House Republicans have called for more fiscal responsibility in federal spending. McCarthy's proposal would freeze spending at last year's level while enacting stricter requirements for social programs and a series of regulatory rollbacks. The proposal met the ire of House and Senate Democrats, who've consistently called for passing a clean debt ceiling increase. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said McCarthy's approach could lead to economic tumult.
If Speaker McCarthy continues in this direction, we are headed to default. The main way we've avoided default in the past is to avoid and reject brinksmanship and hostage-taking, and instead work together in a bipartisan way.
With transgender rights under attack across the country, Washington state lawmakers are trying to protect them. Senate Bill 5599 aids homeless transgender youth and supports abortion care needs. Under current law, young people can only stay at a shelter for 3 days without permission, but this bill removes barriers to safe shelter. State Senator Marco Leas, the bill's sponsor, said Washington state is making itself a welcoming place for transgender people.
Especially at the national level, where the headlines just can be so hopeless, there are places in this country that care about our trans community and are doing what we can to be supportive and ensure that they can be as successful as possible.
Over 50 tribes and First Nations are demanding Canada end its support for the Enbridge Line 5 oil pipeline. In a petition to the UN's Human Rights Council, they're claiming this pipeline threatens the human rights of Indigenous communities and the environment. Canada invoked a 1977 pipeline treaty blocking any meaningful progress. Whitney Gravel, president of the Bay Mills Indian community, says this is about maintaining the sovereignty of Indigenous and First Nations people.
Ultimately, the reason we're involved is in order to protect the future of not only the state of Michigan and the water quality of the Great Lakes, but also to continue to protect the future of our Indigenous lifeways.
Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders is expected to sign a bill creating the Election Integrity Unit of the State Attorney General's Office. The goal of this new unit is to investigate potential voter fraud, though some feel this isn't a major problem. According to the Heritage Foundation, there have only been 3 proven cases of voter fraud in Arkansas, ending with criminal convictions in the past 2 decades. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Crowds from around the nation traveled to the Indiana Convention Center in Indianapolis over the weekend to attend the National Rifle Association's annual convention. Around 70,000 attendees were anticipated at the largest gathering of gun rights enthusiasts in the country to attend seminars, visit vendor booths, and hear speeches from former President Donald Trump and others. Terry D. has more.
The speaker roster included former Vice President Mike Pence, who was greeted with boos from the crowd, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, U.S. Senators Mike Braun and Tim Scott, and possible presidential contender Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Hoosiers concerned about gun violence, President Jerry King questioned why Indianapolis hosted the convention.
How disappointed we are that the city of Indianapolis has welcomed this organization whose policies are so much out of step with the nation, an unrigid position on opposing moderate, reasonable gun reform. Those policies result in people dying.
Outside the center, protesters held signs saying protect kids, not guns. According to the gun safety group Everystat, guns are the leading cause of death among children and teens in Indiana. On average, 110 children and teens die by guns. 31% of these deaths are suicides and 63% are homicides. Another accidental fatal shooting happened Sunday afternoon in Indianapolis, the last day of the convention. A child died from injuries consistent with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Gun deaths and injuries cost Indiana $7 billion a year, of which $300 million is paid by taxpayers. The NRA is viewed as the most powerful gun rights organization in the country and generally does not contribute to lawmakers who push for more gun legislation. King was asked if he thinks the convention speakers stand firm with gun rights supporters, or is their rhetoric a platform for their own political agenda?
Sometimes people, especially politicians, have views more moderate than the ones that they speak in public. When it comes to making decisions, I think they're going to act on those pretty extreme positions that the NRA stakes out.
A controversial permitless bill opposed by law enforcement and anti-gun violence groups was signed into law last year by Governor Holcomb. The law removes the requirement for an Indiana resident to have a handgun permit to legally carry, conceal, or transport a handgun within the state. I'm Terry D., Indiana News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Brain injury from domestic violence is an unrecognized public health challenge, and new research shows how a set of tools called CARE can help staff at domestic violence service organizations recognize signs of traumatic brain injury. Nadia Ramlagan speaks with a public health professor about this toolkit in Ohio.
People with no formal health training may be able to spot signs of brain injury in domestic violence survivors using a set of tools called CARE, which stands for Connect, Acknowledge, Respond, and Evaluate. Severe intimate partner violence is often targeted at the head and neck and in the airways. But Ohio State University professor Juliana Nemeth explains that since these injuries are often invisible, staff at domestic violence service organizations and medical providers may not be aware of how best to meet a survivor's needs. She says brain injuries impact a person's cognitive function, decision-making, and planning ability.
The other impact of brain injury can be things like seizures and constant headache, balance problems, anger and rage, ability to control emotions. Those are all things that impact survivors' daily function.
Nemeth recently co-authored a paper on the effectiveness of the CARE model. She says its 4 cornerstones include connecting with survivors, acknowledging that head trauma, strangulation, and related challenges are common, responding by collaborating with survivors to develop accommodations for challenges related to suspected brain injury caused by violence, and evaluating services by establishing a strong feedback loop with survivors to ensure their needs are being met. Nemeth adds that memory problems, depression, and suicidal thoughts can also be affected by trauma to the brain.
Emerging literature really is suggesting to us that brain injury from domestic violence is not only prevalent, but it's really having neurologic, psychologic, cognitive, and behavioral impact.
Ohio's domestic violence shelters provided emergency housing to nearly 10,000 people last year. Nadia Ramlagan reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview on Ronald Reagan's October surprise. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather, we'll see a consistent drizzle and a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy as well, with a high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1955, German theoretical physicist Albert Einstein died. He was known as one of the most influential physicists in all of time, credited for developing the theory of relativity. He also made considerable strides in quantum physics. The quote of the day is from Einstein, who said, quote, "I am enough of an artist to draw freely from my imagination. Imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world." Water access for the Jemex Pueblo tribe in New Mexico is taking decades to realize. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For 40 years, Jemex Pueblo in New Mexico has been working to access water the tribe says it's owed by the federal government. KUNR's Kayla Bradle has more.
It's a gray and snowy day in late winter on the Jemez Pueblo Reservation in north-central New Mexico. Peter Madalena is standing on the banks of the Jemez River, a tributary of the Rio Grande. Madalena says the river's higher than it has been in recent winters, thanks to more days like this one, filled with snow.
It's a blessing that we're getting it because we're going to have more water and hopefully more people plant.
Madalena is the Pueblo's first lieutenant governor. He's also a lifelong farmer, like many here at Jemez. The tribe doesn't own any casinos or large energy sources. They're largely supported by farming, with corn and chilies being their primary crops. That means they rely heavily on this river, which they divert for agriculture.
The crop from the seed up as they say, we grow together. So that's what we're trying to protect here, the water.
But that hasn't always been easy. Back in 1938, New Mexico, Colorado, and Texas signed a compact that divided the Rio Grande Basin waters among the states. But native tribes and pueblos didn't have a seat at the table. That forced them to negotiate settlements or file lawsuits, even though their rights predate all water users. Paul S. Chinana is a five-term Jemez Pueblo governor and member of the tribal water team. He's been involved with negotiations since they started back in 1983.
We've been having a lot of water shortages for as long as I can remember. And there was a lot of people that were moving in upstream.
As more water users, mainly homes and businesses, are built to the north, less of it flows down to Jemez. And there's another ongoing challenge impacting the amount of available water.
Drought. It's just hard to get everything running normal like it's supposed to run.
For National Native News, I'm Caleb Bradle.
This story is supported by the Water Desk, an initiative from the University of Colorado Boulder's Center for Environmental Journalism. The city of San Antonio, Texas, recently named Chicano poet Neftali De Leon as the city's poet laureate. The bilingual, bicultural artist says he'll not only represent his Mexican-American culture in the post, but also his indigenous roots. Maria Martin reports.
The son of migrant worker, 78-year-old Neftali De Leon, is known for his children's stories, his visual art, and most of all, for his code-switching poetry.
Our ancient Yanawana Springs, where you can even dance a West Side Polka, an accordion tune, con la chiquita banana.
At his investiture as San Antonio's Poet Laureate, De Leon told National Native News he and all Chicanos from the Southwest are rooted in the ancient indigenous Mexica culture.
We still carry the same blood of our ancestors. We come from myth and legend. We come from the serpent and the eagle standing on the cactus, devouring a serpent. That's a metaphor, that it is, again, an encounter between matter and spirit, because that is the totality of creation, matter and spirit.
Neftali De Leon will serve as San Antonio's Poet Laureate for the next 3 years, promoting the art of poetry while celebrating the diverse culture and history of this Texas city. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The California Fish and Game Commission is meeting tomorrow and Thursday to consider ways to reduce bycatch from gillnets set offshore. They threaten non-targeted species like marine mammals, seabirds, sharks, rays, skates, and other fish. Now, a new report explains the damage they cause. Suzanne Potter has the story.
Massive mile-long gillnets weighted to the seafloor 3 miles off the California coast are set to catch halibut or sea bass, but end up entangling more than 125 species of marine life, according to a new report from Oceana and the Turtle Island Restoration Network. The California Fish and Game Commission meets tomorrow and Thursday to discuss whether the bycatch is at acceptable levels. Marine scientist Caitlin Birch with Oceana says 64% of the animals caught in this way are thrown back to sea.
This high rate of bycatch raises concerns over the fishery's wastefulness and impacts on California's marine biodiversity. However, fishery managers have not been tracking how much fishing effort is occurring in the set gillnet fishery, so we don't actually know the true toll on wildlife.
The analysis found that the set gillnets are ensnaring sharks, skates, rays, endangered whales, sea lions, and many species of commercial and recreational fish, including damaged and undersized California halibut, rock crab, sand bass, and lingcod. 29 fishing boats currently hold permits to fish 3 miles offshore. Birch says a key way to reduce bycatch from set gillnets would be to reduce the number of fishing permits.
California voters and fishery managers have taken action in the past to ban this non-selective gear in nearshore waters, which has resulted in major rebounds of vulnerable fish and marine mammal populations. So we do know that removing these nets has a positive impact on many vulnerable species.
The Fish and Game Commission has a toolkit of options to reduce bycatch, but is still deciding whether action is warranted in this fishery. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
French President Emmanuel Macron gave a hands-off commitment on Taiwan to China in a recent meeting. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. French President Emmanuel Macron and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen just visited China. You can bet Joe Biden and his national security team are gnashing their teeth over Macron's Gaullist diplomacy. So are many Europeans. It's not just the predictably fruitless attempt to persuade the Chinese to help negotiate an end to the war in Ukraine. It's also Macron's touting of French strategic autonomy, in tune with Xi Jinping's long-standing aim to drive a wedge between Europe and the US. Macron allowed Xi to get away with saying nothing consequential on Ukraine. No criticism of Russia, no commitment to a peace process, not even a promise to make a phone call to President Zelensky, while simply repeating the mantra about how awful use of nuclear weapons would be and how essential is humanitarian aid to war victims. Washington must be particularly chagrined that Macron would give Beijing the gift of promising to stay out of the tensions over Taiwan. Macron had the audacity, moreover, to speak for Europe when he said the great risk Europe faces is that it, quote, gets caught up in crises that are not ours, which prevents it from building its strategic autonomy. In an interview, he was quite specific, quote, the question Europeans need to answer is it in our national interest to accelerate a crisis on Taiwan? No. The worst thing would be to think that we Europeans must become followers on this topic and take our cue from the U.S. agenda and the Chinese overreaction. That unqualified support of the One China principle was surely music to Xi Jinping's ears. Macron and von der Leyen aren't on the same page, however. Not on world order, not on Taiwan and Ukraine, not on human rights. Prior to the trip, Xi issued a blunt statement about China's efforts to establish a new world order. As reported by the Wall Street Journal, in that new order, she said, individual rights are subordinated to national sovereignty, where security and economy take prominence over political and civil rights. She's on the mark. Xi Jinping's Global Security Initiative, announced several months ago, proposes a development model in which regime security, internal controls, and divorce from Western commercial and financial institutions are central to a country's stability and prosperity. On Taiwan, von der Leyen again departed from Macron's hands-off statement. She told Xi, quote, the threat of or the use of force to change the status quo is unacceptable, and it's important that the tensions that might occur should be resolved through dialogue. Neither her declaration, however, nor Macron's stance kept China from carrying out a three-day military exercise near Taiwan, evidently in retaliation for Kevin McCarthy's hosting of Taiwan's president. As for the war in Ukraine, von der Leyen took a much tougher and more principled stance than Macron. In the same speech that I mentioned, she was critical of China's peace plan, saying that any proposal, quote, which would in effect consolidate Russian annexations of Ukrainian territory, and that's precisely what China's proposal does, is simply not a viable plan. How China continues to interact with Putin's war will be a determining factor for EU-China relations, she added. That was not at all but Macron's message to Xi, probably because he and the many business executives who accompanied him are more concerned about trade and the EU's trade deficit with China, over $400 billion, than about human rights. Reportedly, Macron said nothing about Xinjiang or Hong Kong. In short, the Chinese have plenty of reasons to believe their lavish attention to Macron paid off. They drew him to their side on the war and Taiwan, without giving anything of substance in return. From China's standpoint, the EU visit marks another diplomatic win over weak links in the US chain of partners, such as Saudi Arabia, whose normalization of ties with Iran was brokered by China, and Brazil, which has agreed with China to use their own currencies rather than the dollar in trade. Now Beijing can add France to the list. But we should not exaggerate China's diplomatic achievements, as some observers are doing. It has had plenty of setbacks. Its Belt and Road Initiative has increasingly made China a merchant of debt for lender and borrower alike. Its hoped-for investment treaty with Europe is a dead letter. Its attempt to disrupt U.S. security alliances in Europe and Asia has failed, and its abuses of human rights have been widely condemned. So, while the French fared poorly in China, let's also point out when China has fared poorly in Europe and elsewhere. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 18, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote productions team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, David Rosenberg, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Terry D. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News In Depth. The New York Times recently published a long article about the so-called October surprise, that is, the story of how supporters of the 1980 Republican presidential candidate Ronald Reagan conspired with the Iranian government to keep 52 American hostages from being freed until after the election, thereby ensuring that incumbent President Jimmy Carter would be defeated. Political operative Ben Barnes told The Times that he had gone with his mentor, former Texas Governor John Connally, on a mission to the Middle East countries to try to prevent the hostages from being released. The article briefly mentions Robert Perry, the journalist who did so much to break the story in spite of the obstacles he faced. Nat Perry is an independent journalist and editor of American Dispatches, a Robert Perry reader. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
What's going on with the reporting of the October surprise? What did the New York Times do, and was it really an adequate way of describing what happened?
They brought some new reporting to the story. It seems to me that this guy, Ben Barnes, who I guess was a protege of John Connally, who worked, I guess they worked for the Reagan campaign in 1980. And from what I could gather from this story in the New York Times by Peter Baker, was that Ben Barnes, I guess, has a bit of a crisis of conscience with Jimmy Carter being in hospice care. And, you know, I guess he'll be probably passing away any day now. And, you know, at least according to him, you know, that was his motivation for coming forward, that he wanted to try to set the record straight. And so the New York Times published this piece that, I thought it was generally a pretty good piece, well-researched. So Ben Barnes is claiming that he went with John Connally in the summer of 1980, in July, I believe, on a multi-country visit to the Middle East.